Mr. Angaron, if you would, as soon as, oh. Mr. Angaron? Yes.
We are here today because 13 years ago, this court in Coates versus Penrod struggled with the apportion of fault when you have a potentially absent or insolvent tortfeasor. Six members of this court, in a very able dissenting opinion, questioned whether the fault of another defendant can be attributed to the defendant in that case.
That's a battle I waged for years and years and have consistently lost, although I still think I'm right about it.
Being a professor, I get to teach that you are right is part of my many articles. But the question that you asked in that case, Judge Garwood, was why should a defendant ever be liable to the plaintiff for a greater proportion of the plaintiff's damages than the defendant's negligence is of the total negligence of the plaintiff and defendant? Now, the majority disagreed, as you well know, as Judge Garza knows as well from that great case. The majority disagreed and held that under joint and several liability, the percentage fault of the other defendants or non-defendants and who knows who else is attributed to the defendant in that case. And that's why we are here today. We are here today because that's water under the bridge. Absolutely. But what we can do today is ameliorate the harsh effect of that decision. What we can do today is what we ask is that when the defendant in the suit settles under the threat of joint and several liability, that defendant can take an assignment of the plaintiff so that it can pursue the responsible party that wasn't in the case. That's all we're asking today. And there is ample precedent from this court and from the common law to support that rule.
Is there ample precedent when that settling defendant is the insurer of the person it wants to sue?
Absolutely. In fact, this court, in all the general rule is that you can't sue your own insured for risks for which that insured is covered under the policy. I could not agree more. Absolutely could not agree more. What you have in this is a typical indemnity situation in the offshore setting. You have Diamond, who's being defended under a GL policy. Urest is the employer. They're liable under the EL policy. The GL policy, of course, excludes EL. The GL carrier is suing the insured solely for the EL exposure. And as I cited to you, a perfect example of that is the Rosado case in New York, which is very close. New York law is the same as this court. In fact, Judge Brown in the Peavy case, my great mentor, Judge Brown, who wrote the Peavy case, and what he said was, he said, of course you can sue your insured, but you can only sue them for risks that aren't covered under the policy. The EL to Urest, SHRM Catering, is absolutely excluded from our policy. There's no harm in suing them. The Rosado case from New York that we cited is a perfect case because National Union, AIG in that case, was forced to defend under an indemnity provision. They did that under their GL contract. But then they wanted to bring in and sued their own insured for the EL exposure. And the New York court said you can, of course, absolutely do that because EL is not covered under GL.
Mr. Angaron, did you argue that in your brief? I don't recall that argument in your brief, this distinction between the GL insurer suing.
It's in the reply brief because the first time that this was raised was on appeal.
You didn't?
In the district court, this issue wasn't brought up.
Okay.
He raised that on appeal for the first time.
Suing your own insured is what he raised. Is what you're saying, that on appeal he raised the issue of suing your own insured?
Yes.
Okay.
And so we addressed it in our reply brief, and addressed it, and in a supplemental, letter brief as well.
The only mention
in the trial court was a one sentence saying that this is of course more odious because you're suing your own insured, and the courts have said there's nothing odious about it. This is just one insurance company versus another insurance company.
But it seems to me you say that you're put in an untenable position because you might got stuck and so forth. But why couldn't you bring in this party?
We moved to bring them in, and Judge Kent, with his rocket docket, refused to let us do that.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the whole problem with your case, as far as I can see.
Mm-hmm.
If, let's just assume that you tried to bring them in at the last minute because you didn't want to go to trial then, and you really wanted to take some other depositions or something like that, so we can get a mm-hmm. delay by. That ought not to be an excuse.
It shouldn't be an excuse. If that happened, that wouldn't be an excuse.
Now, we cannot review, in this case, Judge Kent's order that you raised it too late. We have got to assume that he was right. And I think maybe that puts you in a hard place, because he wasn't right all the time about everything like all of us. But we can't run our business that any other way.
Okay.
So if you assume he was right, then what we are assuming is you did not exercise the rights that the law gave you to protect yourself. And we do not need to bend the law in this case to protect you.
Right, but if this isn't a bending of the law, you don't need to bend the law in this case. Let's look at what the precedents are under the common law. We're not asking for any bending of the law, Judge. We're not. The common law from this court under Admiralty, starting with Judge Brown, my mentor again, in the Wilkins case, and then with Judge King in the Bass case. What happened in Bass was you had the defendants in the case, which, assuming that we had been able to bring them in Judge Kent's rocket docket, assuming we'd been able to do that, but we weren't in this case, because the problem was...
But you weren't. We've got to, see, we have to accept
and
that
accept-
you weren't, because you didn't follow what the proper procedure for doing so. That is, you didn't do it timely and
let's
so
assume,
on and so forth.
It actually was timely. There was no
doubt. Yeah, I know that, but
Judge
I'm
Kent
not
denied
going...
It. Judge Kent denied it, and won. I'm not going there. The point is that if we had them in the case, this court allows an assignment already in the Bass case. And all of the principles that are used in the district court cases that are cited by SHRM, all of those principles, one by one, down the line, were rejected by this court, every single one. And those were when Judge Fisher's opinion in Bass, were number one, that there is a possibility of confusion and problem with the parties and whatnot.
Of confusion.
Mm-hmm. Number two, that there's champeter maintenance. The main reason for the common law general rule against assignments. And number three, that it's prejudicial to the remaining defendants. And Judge King went down the line one by one and rejected each one of those. She said, first, with respect to champerty, the district judge had already rejected. The district judge initially said, of course, common law prevents this because it's champertous. And the district judge pulled that back and said, of course, this isn't champertous. There's nothing champertous about one defendant buying that cause of action because they're not disinterested parties. Okay, so that's not a champerty issue. He withdrew it. The Fifth Circuit said that was right to withdraw that because there is no champerty issue here at all. Then the court rejected the issue with respect to there being prejudice to the defendant, saying that the plaintiff can pick out anybody they want and settle with them, and there's absolutely no prejudice to the remaining defendants whatsoever. I commend you the Bass case because the analysis is very straightforward, and it rejects that out of hand. And then thirdly, as to confusion, the district court had said there was no confusion because you just simply instruct the jury on how you're going to address that. So this court had already, before the line of cases from Florida district court came out, had already rejected each and every one of the bases in that decision. But then, before that case came out, the district court in Rhode Island in Dissin dealt with an assignment of a seaman's personal injury complaint. Okay? And in that case, you had a vessel sinking at sea. And the vessel owner is confronted with a claim by a seaman. And what the court did was the court said, or the plaintiff assigned the cause of action, the plaintiff's cause of action, to the vessel owner. And the vessel owner pursued it, and the plaintiff wasn't allowed to do it because the assignment was perfectly valid. And the court went through the same arguments that this court did in Bass in upholding the Mary Carter agreement, Mary Carter assignment in Bass. They went through the same arguments and said there's no champerty here because these parties aren't disinterested parties. There's no harm or prejudice, no possible misalignment or confusion because those can all be taken care of. But this is what the district court said. This is a maritime personal injury assignment case before these cases came up that are relied upon by the defendant. And the court said this about the common law. It said the common law prohibiting assignments was designed to avoid the evils of champerty. We agree. Applying that rule where champerty is absent would be to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We don't reject the general prohibition against purchasing of personal injury claims for profit. We simply cannot allow this salutary rule to be used in a context where it has no meaning, and to obstruct an appropriate device for payment of a claim by an insurance carrier that has an obligation to absolve its insured of liability without depriving itself of the right to pursue action against another insurance carrier. So the common law, maritime personal injury claims, perfectly assignable using the exact analysis of this court.
But the case, it seemed to me that the party who had made the assignment was trying to pretend it hadn't made the assignment, so come in itself, and it was trying to have its cake and eat it too, which we have kind of a prejudice against that.
Right, but the
but
point...
But that's not the case here.
It's not. But the point of this case here, Your Honor, is that all of the principles that this court enunciated in Bass, every one of those is absolutely applicable to the assignment that the court did in dissent. And when you look at
We refused in Bass to throw out Mary Carter agreements.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's basically what the holding in Bass, that Mary Carter agreements, we will not say that they're illegal. But in Mary Carter agreements, all the parties have remained before the court, and you get a finding of the proportionate responsibility, if any.
And you will
the beneficiary of the Mary Carter agreement, the settling co-defendant, or whatever you want to call them, you can bring that out before the jury.
And you can do that,
But the problem with your situation is it gives rise to a second suit. There's only one suit in the Mary Carter agreement. And there would have been only one suit if you had brought in this party in the original suit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you didn't bring them in. Now, you said, we didn't know it on time or whatever. But we're stuck with what Judge Kent ruled. Now, if Judge Kent had ruled real bad, you might have tried to get a mandamus, or you might even had an appeal or something like that. But this is another case we got to assume that he did it right.
And I don't have a problem with that because...
So what we got to make a rule for, can somebody choose not to bring someone in another case and then try to have a third case? And that's what you're asking us to do. And I don't see why we ought to do it.
Because it's just like in DeSin, there's no problem, there's no prejudice to that defendant. They're going to be, let's put it this way.
But there's prejudice to the system.
Your Honor,
it's multiplicitous litigation. It could have all been resolved in one suit.
But the thing is, there would have had to have been a trial in the other case, you see? And so there's no more waste of judicial resources because in the other case you would have had to have a trial. So
but
in order to preserve
a trial
both.
With everybody's share before the one jury.
Mm-hmm. At the same
or
time?
Or one fact finder or whatever.
Right, but under the analysis in Bass, that's not prejudicial to the defendants in any way. It might cause there to
it's
be another...
It's prejudicial to the taxpayers. It's prejudicial to the system to have more than one lawsuit.
It is,
Your Honor. McDermott tells us, I think the Supreme Court said that's one of the factors that we consider in crafting the common law in the maritime area, isn't it?
It is one of the factors, Your Honor. But the thing is that take a situation where it's an absent defendant. So you would say when it's an absent defendant or you can't get them the assignment, there's no problem. But if you actually could have brought them in, then you can't assign. You see, the point is that there's...
Absent, you mean you can't reach them by process or what?
Can't reach them by process in that case or there's some other reason why you can't get them into the suit. You see, for example... you could have, you're talking about the situation where the defendant's not subject to process there. Or how about the situation in which, like in DeSin, where you settle before there's ever a suit? See, it really doesn't make sense to create an exception to the Bass reasoning for that one little circumstance where we tried to bring him in but didn't get him into the case.
What about the one where you didn't even try?
Right, but that would be another circumstance. But you see, the reasoning in the Bass case doesn't make for a difference in those circumstances because what you have is there's no waste of judicial resources because you would have them all in one suit, but you're going to still have to go to trial in one case, and there hasn't been a trial that was settled out.
So I think the thinking is that the results are more reliable where you have everybody before the fact finder, and he's got to make one decision about everybody then, rather than making decisions without everybody before the court, two decisions without everybody before the court.
But that happens when one of the parties settles. Still, you're raising you're trying percentages of fault in that circumstance, even when you don't have all the parties present before the court. That happens all the time. That's not something that's prejudicial.
But if you can have them before the court, you ought to have them.
Your Honor, that's absolutely true. The question is, we couldn't get them in this case, and so all we're asking
is... I can't buy that you couldn't get them in. I'm sorry. If we say it turns on that...
It doesn't turn on that. All I am asking is that the court enforce the rule that when there's no champerty present... When there's no champerty present, there's no reason to bar an assignment. Appreciate it very much, Your Honors.
Mr. Ammerman.
May it please the court, my name is Matthew Ammerman, and I'm here with my co-counsel, Ryan Perdue, and we represent SHRM doing business as Eurest. Judge Garwood, you picked up on the point that I believe controls today, which is there is a remedy for Lexington that is Rule 14C, specific to admiralty cases here where they can bring in a party they believe is responsible and have the responsibility assessed.
He says, well, what about the deal where you can't reach that party by process?
If you can't reach the party by process, there could be other methods to try to get your money back. And in this case, they most definitely could have been reached. It was an issue of timeliness, as you pointed out. I'm not aware, Your Honor, of any cases that specifically address that. I can look at that and send a letter brief later. But in this case, Lexington, a suit was filed, Ann Wells' suit was filed on May 30 of 2005. Lexington's motion through Diamond to try to bring Eurest into the case was not filed until April of 2006, less than 2 months prior to trial. And what Ms. Wells argues against that motion, she did not want Urist in the case, is that it was too late. Judge Kent denied the motion. Lexington had remedies, not only bringing a timely Rule 14c claim. They could have appealed it. They could have mandamused Judge Kent. They could have, if they believe this is a coverage dispute, as they have indicated, reserved rights, brought a declaratory judgment action, other opportunities to have this resolved, but they did not do that. This is a bad way to give Lexington a second bite at the apple. We believe that Judge Atlas's opinion below should be affirmed for three reasons. First, the overwhelming weight of authority says that a tortfeasor or its insurer cannot take an assignment and prosecute another putative tortfeasor. Second, as I've indicated, Lexington had remedies. And finally, that even under the rule that Lexington proposes, this assignment, where it is an insurer taking an assignment against its insured, should fail.
Now, he's making the distinction that this are different risks. What's your response to that?
To the extent that it was a coverage dispute, there are mechanisms to address a coverage dispute. Mr. Angeron brings up
I presume, it has to be the same factual scenario. Is it not? I mean, the injury occurred aboard ship or aboard, the Ocean Lexington. It's a personal injury suit, is it not?
Yes, sir.
The factual scenario is absolutely the same. And
the argument was whether her co-employee was responsible or that she was a contractor or an employee of a contractor and catering contractor, and did she step on a banana peel that her co-employee left on the floor, or was the vessel negligent and not mopping up things promptly? Is that about it?
Yes, Your Honor. I was not involved in the Ann Wells case, but that's my understanding from the reading of the record. She claimed that there was wet wax on the floor, and in another instance, some boxes fell on her. And her position in that case was that ultimately Diamond, vessel owner, you are responsible. And she also claimed that Diamond was her borrowing employer and brought Jones Act claims against Diamond. Lexington settled those claims. It voluntarily settled those claims. It didn't seek an appeal. It didn't timely try to 14C in Urist. It chose to settle those claims.
But these are negligent. The legal background is the same, whether or not, in other words, there's a negligent cause of action, whether or not it was caused by this co-employee or the ship and failing to sweep the deck.
To the extent of trying to apportion liability or responsibility?
Yes.
Yes, that's what they were seeking to do, is to try to have that liability determined. Presumably, that's why they filed the Rule 14.
What I'm trying to comprehend is whether there is a distinction without a difference here between the insurer cannot sue its insured, and the scenario here where, in essence, you have one set of circumstances, in whether or not that somehow, whether a second suit should be then, prohibited and or the assignment prohibited in this case.
Your Honor's picked up on that, in that there is one proceeding where Urist would have been brought in under 14C. Everyone would have had a seat at the table. If there were any settlements, it would be in full view of all parties, and we wouldn't have the problem of a second lawsuit brought by Urist Insurance Company against Urist. So I believe that is one of the major differences as between a 14C motion and this assignment, and I believe that the policy concerns here are especially important, namely prejudice. Here you have Urist Insurance Company under Urist policy defending Diamond, and then at the end of that litigation, taking a claim from Ms. Wells and prosecuting its insured. The opportunities for mischief seem to be...
Is there a conflict?
I believe that once there is a conflict of interest, that they have to take action. That's why I made reference to a reservation of rights if there was. If there's a conflict here, yes, looking back at what I see, and again, I wasn't involved in that case, but from what I read from the record, there most definitely was if Lexington, through Diamond, was on notice of URS potential liability and that it was going to seek, it either was on notice or should have been on notice because URS is mentioned from the outset of the litigation, that they then should have noticed that conflict of interest and should have put their insured on notice if they intended to try to get their money back. And more, mentioning prejudice, the complaint that's filed technically is Ann Wells versus URS, Lexington, of course, standing on her shoes. Mm-hmm. Well, there's even more opportunity for prejudice because Lexington here is asking for punitive damages against its insurer, for attorney's fees against its insurer. Its complaint doesn't only ask for its settlement back. It wants more. Potentially an insurance company in this situation, were this court to allow this type of assignment, could make a profit off of an assigned claim. That's part of the reason why these assignments are not the way to resolve this dispute. Instead, Rule 14C provides that opportunity and does it in one forum in front of all parties to have the issue resolved.
Well, wouldn't there be I'm not sure that I understand that. I get confused. If they had bought in 14C, wouldn't the insurance company have the they had brought in the employer, the catering company, I guess. That's Uresti, is that it?
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
If they had brought them in the original suit, then since they were the insurer, yeah. I mean, somebody else, well, what's going to happen then?
I presume you'd have two sets of attorneys, I guess. With the way separate.
In other words, they would then tell the employer, all right, now we've brought you in, but we are going to, you just go hire who you want, we'll pay for it.
Well, the way it's supposed to work is you have two sets of insurers. You're URS, you have a general liability coverage, you have employer's coverage. And once you get in a dispute, both of those people, and it's not clear who's going to be liable, but they're both insuring the same person. That person is, they both have a duty to make sure that their loyalty is to the insured first and foremost. They both defend under coverages. They defend the suit. The suit comes out however it comes out. And after that, as between the two insurance companies, they duke it out as to who's liable. And here, they're skewing that process because they are not requiring, they're not putting the insured on notice that we're going to come around and make a claim against you.
Well, suppose they did. That's what I mean.
It seems to me there is a conflict.
But can they do that? In other words, like, can they? Is it proper for the insurance company to say that they're going to bring them in and then tell them, okay, we're bringing you in now. Now, you got to get your own counsel, but we'll pay for it. Is that it or what?
Well, most definitely, and to make sure I understand your question, Judge Gardner, you're asking about in a 14C situation,
yeah,
where they're actually brought in. Yes, I believe URS would be entitled to its counsel. It would have a seat at the table. Lexington would have its lawyers appointed to defend Diamond. They would have an absolute duty to be careful and make sure that if there was a conflict of interest, that all parties were properly represented and there was no prejudice to their insurer to whom they owe a special duty.
All right. Now, why can't you do the same thing in this situation? In other words, this insurance, if they were to be allowed to be sued now, why couldn't they just say, okay, now we've got a conflict because we're trying to get some of this settlement back.
This is
and we'll furnish you, we'll go on with our obligation as your insurer, but we've got a conflict of interest in this time, we'll furnish you your own lawyer, you get the lawyer you want, we'll pay for it.
This assignment is different, Your Honor, because they waited until the end of the litigation to take that assignment and essentially switch sides, whereas in what you're posing under 14C, everyone is there, ready to have the issue resolved, and the insurer...
Well, but if they're going to bring this lawsuit now with this assignment, why can't they fulfill their duty to their insured by paying or furnishing a lawyer? Furnish that insured a lawyer.
In a Rule 14C proceeding, I believe that they should. Again, they would have to make sure that they're
doing it in this proceeding. In other words, it's the same deal. And what's the difference, I guess, is what I'm saying.
The difference is that in this case, the non-settling party, which is a common concern of the many, many courts that strike down assignments of this type, does not have a seat at the table, is not represented whenever that settlement is reached. Mr. Angeron made reference to the PV case where – yes, Your Honor.
Finish.
You made reference to the PV case where there was – there was not an assignment, so it's not factually similar in that respect. But there was a coverage dispute, but everyone was there in the litigation. At the close of the litigation, the insurer's lawyer, the insurance company's lawyer agreed, okay, we're going to settle this case, but we're going to reserve this coverage issue.
The question, it seems to me, is when – does the conflict arise that could possibly prejudice the insured? And nothing is wrong in this case until that conflict arises. But when does it arise? When they settle, or when they assign with the view to sue the insured? When does it come up?
Why doesn't it come up when they move to bring that party in? That's what they did. They moved to bring the party in under 14C. And it was unsuccessful, but when the time they made that motion was a conflict right there.
They did definitely by that point have a conflict. I believe, in answer to your question, Judge Garza, it is when they know or should have known that there is a conflict of interest, i.e., another party responsible, that there could be a coverage dispute.
Well, they certainly knew that when they filed a 14C motion.
Well, the insurance company has a duty to investigate. They should have known that from the outset, and it was apparent from the outset that Urest was a potential had potential involvement in this case. It's in the complaint.
All right, so what should they have done about it at that point?
Again, what's the next step now?
They find that out. What are they supposed to do about it?
If they seek to recover against Urest or Urest carrier, then they have to put their insured on notice to make sure that that insured is not prejudiced.
See, one of the questions that I have is even before the 14C motion, if you have some information and you start formulating that I may have a cause of action against my insured, the conflict is already there. And that to me, you don't bring somebody in just to bring somebody in. You have some reasonable belief that and in this case, as soon as I guess the information that the banana peel was on the deck and it was placed by one of the employees, then it seemed to me that right there, there's at least the germ of a conflict has arisen.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree, and that's why I would, specifically answer your question, is when they knew or should have known, and an insurance company has that duty to investigate.
Okay, but
the
what
outset.
Happens then? What is all right? What do they do? Let's put it in this case. There may be an obligation here to this other this company, the catering company, got something in here. I'm sure they're going to owe something about this. Now, what should they do then?
They should send a letter to their insurer, putting them on notice. They should appoint them counsel if they believe
they
that there's
that.
A potential conflict of interest, so that to make sure that insured is protected.
They do that, and they tell them we're gonna bring you in, and they do it more promptly than they did here.
But
what's the difference? That's what I'm getting. How is it any different? They give them the lawyer, pay for their lawyer. I guess they owe them that obligation. And why can't they do that now, pay for their lawyer?
What the cases that have struck down assignments, even not involving an insurer and insured, have said that there is the potential for prejudice to the non-settling party. In what you're proposing, Your Honor, the insured would be involved. They would be on notice. They would have their counsel to protect their rights. Whereas in the cases that strike down these assignments, which is virtually every court that has considered it.
Once you insure, develop evidence that's favorable to you, but is unfavorable to your insured, you got major problems. And the question is, maybe that's the point where you can't even bring a person in because the step has already been taken. I'm trying to talk through this.
Well, they've got two insureds. That's the deal here.
Yes, Your Honor, they do. And I believe that if the insurance company follows the well-established principles of putting their insured on notice in a timely way, once that conflict arises, they should or should have known of the conflict, then they can proceed under 14C and have this issue adjudicated. But they have to make sure that their insured is protected. And the cases that are...
I'm not sure their insured is going to be unprotected in a sense now, because if we allow this suit, you know, to go forward, they can argue that, make all the arguments they could have made before. You know, it really wasn't our fault. It was the ship's fault. And it's the system doesn't like it, because the system prefers to have the fact finder have everybody before it at the same time rather than to make. But I don't know that. Wouldn't you have to pay for it? Wouldn't the insurance company have to? Suppose there's a judgment in favor of Mary, and against her employer, the catering company. Doesn't the insurance company have to pay that judgment?
And they have to defend the claim
and pay the judgment. Isn't that right?
I believe so. Yeah,
then what's the problem? I mean, if they've got to pay the judgment.
Well, the problem is, I want to discuss this with the other counsel, but the problem is that your ultimate insured is Urest. Lexington also insures Urest. And depending on how they try the facts and develop the facts, they can develop the favorable to their position to Urest's detriment. And that's a conflict of interest. They have to step out of the litigation.
Why don't we ask questions while we have the lawyers here, and then we can always discuss it back there.
That's true.
Go ahead. Anything else, Mr.?
Just to say that we have been discussing what I believe is a very important issue in this case, but specifically, this case turns on the validity of the assignment or not. And there are plenty of case law, three district courts applying general maritime law that say this can't be done, even if it doesn't involve an insured.
That's the thing. Is it worse because it involves the insured? That's what you're saying. I've got questions about that. But
if the panel has no more questions.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Mr. Emmerman. Mr. Angeron.
Yes, those three district court cases came out after the contrary case, after the decisions of this court.
But this is totally complicated by the fact that, when I first started reading this brief, I thought.
It's actually a big red herring, Your Honor.
It's not a red herring.
Let me explain. It was not raised before the district court. It's raised for the first time appeal, or we could have addressed all of this in lots of briefing. Lexington has a GL policy. That GL policy requires it provide indemnity to Diamond. Urest has an employer's liability policy. That's who's defending him today. That's who hired him. Urest is being sued under the Jones Act for its employer's liability. That's covered by a different policy. This is simply
different policies,
different carriers.
But it's not different coverages under the same policy.
Correct. It's not, because it's excluded from our policy. But it's excluded. It's excluded from every GL policy. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a GL policy.
Isn't the focus focus not on the policy, not on the insurer, mm-hmm. but on the insured mm-hmm. and whether or not the insured as a party has been prejudiced by anything that has taken place.
Right, and so the point is, in this particular case, we could have developed all this before the district court. As soon as we took the deposition and were allowed by Mr. Spagnoletti to take the plaintiff's deposition, as soon as we took it, we tried to bring him in. And we called their carrier and tried to get them to come to the mediation. We tried to, and they said, no, we're not coming to the mediation. The point is, when you're talking about, you're asking about the prejudice here, we notified them the minute that we came up with evidence involving the liability of the insurer.
Did you notify your insurer, URS, and tell them we've got a conflict of interest, mm-hmm. you need to hire separate counsel?
Well, they weren't in the case.
It doesn't matter if they're in the case.
URS didn't the defendant.
You were their insurer. You were URS insurer. Mm-hmm. Whether they're sued or not, you have an obligation to them not to prejudice them in this litigation.
Well, the only insured that we're defending in this case.
It doesn't matter whether they're in the case or not. You owe a duty to them. You're insured. You have two insureds, Diamond and Urest. Mm-hmm. And you have every incentive in this case to develop the facts in such a way that it's put off on Urest EL carrier as opposed to you. And that's to the detriment of your rest. You have a conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm. The one thing I know is that we did notify their carrier.
We notified your rest.
We notified your rest.
And did you back out and say, we can no longer defend
Diamond?
You need to get separate counsel to monitor this because we're going to skew the facts in a way that are, assuming you're not insured, are going to put you on the hook.
Well, there wasn't anything after that. We went to mediation and settled. And we did invite URIST's carrier to come to the mediation, and they declined.
But don't.
Yes.
Now, how do you insure URIST?
They're the named insured on a general liability policy.
All right. That you issued?
Yes, sir.
All right. Now, if in this suit you are able to sue URIST in the name of Mary.
Mm-hmm.
And you recover a judgment against them. Mm-hmm. Don't you pay that judgment
no,
that you
paid by their EL carrier? It's just like Rosado. And the case I commend you is the Rosado case.
But the way this is supposed to work is you know, everybody is on notice what you're going to do. You don't do it after the fact and then pop up and say, okay, now we're going to go through in another guise, a reservation of rights to duke it out between the competing insurance companies. You've already participated in litigation and skewed the facts in your favor.
We had the opportunity. We didn't do that in this case because we defended them.
But that's you had the opportunity, and that's the point.
Yeah, but that's because the only party in it, that's because Spagnoletti only sues the vessel owner. And so you're defending the vessel owner, and you defend the facts. And when Spagnoletti finally lets you take the plaintiff's deposition 2 months before, 3 months before trial, he lets you take that deposition, and you take that deposition, and you discover the facts in the case. And so you immediately move to bring in the responsible party. You notify the insured to get their carrier.
Well, that's what you tell us, but Judge Kent didn't quite see it.
No, the only reason we're talking about this here today is because this wasn't vetted in the district court. It was raised for the first time on appeal. That's why we're talking about it here today. I'm not complaining about what Judge Kent did. I'm just telling you why, as soon as we were notified by the plaintiff's testimony of the responsibility of URIST, we notified URIST to get their carrier, notified their carrier, and asked their carrier to participate. Their carrier declined. And so we did what we were responsible to do. We tried to get their carrier to participate and resolve all of this in one proceeding. But the key point here, once again, is that when you read the cases like Dessin, which were the maritime cases in effect at the time that the casino case came out.
Let me ask you this question. Let's suppose that you defended under reservation of rights. You told Diamond and you told URS, look, we don't think you're liable. We don't think this is covered. We're going to settle it, and then we're going to sue URS EL carrier and say, this is your liability, not ours. It's a simple contract dispute between insurers. Why, if you've got that remedy, should we give you an assignment of punitive damages rights?
And punitive damages.
Well, you could allege that. Why do you need the personal injury assignment? Don't you have other remedies?
What is that remedy?
To pay settle it and say, you know, this really isn't our obligation. This is URS' obligation under its EL policy.
Well, this court has never upheld the right of contribution in that circumstance. We don't know whether that exists. So we're faced with the situation of a Hobson's choice. We can either take an assignment, which we know is valid under the rules of this court, or what we can do is we can try and seek contribution in a separate action, which has never been upheld by this court after AmClyde. So what we need from you is to tell us today, do you do it by assignment or by contribution? We can
do it by a timely 14C is what we're saying.
Mr. Angrin.
You can do that in some courts, Your Honor.
Mr. Angrin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your case is under submission. We'll take a 15-minute recess.